Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's military seizes power and declares state of emergency.
Crowds of protesters marched on the streets of the Sudanese capital Khartoum Monday to express their opposition to the military takeover of the country and the dissolution of the joint civilian-military government.
Sudan's Unionist Alliance calls for suspension of Sudan from international bodies. A demand for unconditional release of all political prisoners in Eswatini, Somalia's Puntland state, conducts direct local council elections. Nigeria's president launches the country's digital currency, and Uganda suffers its second deadly bomb blast in 3 days.
Two people so far have been reported dead. The Ugandan police has issued a statement and confirmed the blast and said the team had been dispatched to go to the ground and find out the details.
And improving access for disabled people in Nigeria. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Top Sudanese General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan said in a televised address on Monday that he has declared a nationwide state of emergency and dissolved the joint civilian-military government. Al-Burhan said the move was necessary due to quarrels among political parties ahead of a planned transition to civilian rule. Protests broke out in Khartoum earlier after Prime Minister Abdel Hamdok was arrested by military units and taken, along with his wife, to an unknown location. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Crowds of protesters marched on the streets of the Sudanese capital Khartoum Monday to express their opposition to the military takeover of the country and the dissolution of the joint civilian-military government earlier in the day. Amateur video showed protesters burning tires and blocking main roads. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who led the sovereign council that ruled the country for the past 2 years, said in a televised speech that he had dissolved the government due to political quarrels that were threatening the security of the country and insisted that a new government of technocrats will soon be appointed. He says that divisions among various components of the government were threatening the security of the country. He insists that constitutional texts will be respected and that a new government composed of independent technocrats will be appointed. Adam Harika, a spokesman for deposed Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, told Arab media that the army took Dr. Hamdok to an undisclosed location and that his supporters are holding those who ousted him responsible for his security and safety. We call for his immediate release, he added, and we believe the Sudanese people will oppose what he called this coup. Miriam Sadiq al-Mahdi, leader of Sudan's Hezbollah Ummah party and foreign minister in the outgoing government of Dr. Hamdok, told Arab media that her party opposes any coup by any party and for any justification, and that we will fight it by all peaceful civilian means, defending the constitutional document that Sudan's young people have paid for with their blood. Hussam Zaki, Deputy Secretary General of the Arab League, told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that the League calls on both parties to observe the constitutional document put in place after the 2019 ouster of veteran former leader Omar al-Bashir, as the Arab League was a party to the document. He said the current situation raises worries, and the League is calling on all parties to respect the document until the end of the interim period and not to royal security in the country. As the day went on, internet service inside Sudan was reportedly cut, and communications with the country became extremely difficult, with phone lines cut in the middle of interviews by Arab media with Sudanese political leaders. The U.S. envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, who was in Khartoum over the weekend, said in a statement that he was deeply alarmed by reports of the apparent coup in Sudan. He added that any changes to Sudan's transitional government by forces puts U.S. assistance to the country at risk. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Unionist Alliance, a founding member of Sudan's civilian-led transitional government headed by Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, has condemned Monday's military coup in Sudan. The group said in a statement that it believes the Sudanese people will triumph over the military. Musa Murawe, a member of the Unionist Alliance, says the group is calling on all partners of Sudan, including the United States and all free people of the world, to condemn the coup. Murawe also says the African Union and all other international bodies should suspend Sudan's membership.
We are watching with grave concern the unfolding situation in the country. And we're hoping that this difficult moment will pass and this will be the end of military rule in Sudan. It doesn't look like it right now, but the people and everyone and our friends from around the world whose support we appreciate and ask for are all in one page, and that page is there is no other option for Sudan but to be ruled by a civilian government and to transition to democracy.
Now, what role did your group play in the formation of the transitional government that has now been overthrown?
We played a major role. We are a founding member of the Alliance for Freedom and Change. We were part of the peace agreement that brought together the military and the civilian partners. And we have ministers and other officials in the civilian government of Prime Minister Hamdok.
Now, you mentioned General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. He says that the military was taken over to what he called rectify the revolution's cause. What do you think about that statement?
I think nothing can be further from the truth. This is a gimmick. They have been planning this. They have never really been serious about the roles they were supposed to do in the last 2 years, which is to reform the military and to unite the military and the security forces. And they were only half-heartedly in there. And now it is clear, now that a moment has come, which is the time in which, according to the partnership agreement, rule is supposed to be changed from the military partner leadership to the civilian partner leadership. And of course, they did not want to take that seriously or accept it. And that is why they launched this coup. It's a coup. It is a 100% coup. It has been rejected by the people and their democratic representatives.
What do you think the international community can do in this instance? Say the African Union, the United States, European Union, what can they do? What do you want them to do?
I think the African Union should suspend Sudan membership, and so is all other international bodies. I think unless these coup people give the government back to Prime Minister Hamdok and go back to the agreement to transition the country to civilian rule, I think they should not be recognized and they should certainly be punished for this act they have just did.
It's a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling and thank you for your time.
Musa Murawe is a member of the Unionist Alliance of Sudan. He was speaking with us from Fairfax, Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C. Uganda suffered its second bomb blast in 3 days on Monday. Police said two people died and several others injured on Monday in an explosion that took place on a bus in the country's central Mpigi district. Another bomb blast this past Saturday killed a 20-year-old woman and injured three others in Kampala. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for both attacks. Alex Atuhera, editor of the Uganda PML Daily, says police have sent bomb investigators to the scene of the latest blast and that President Yoweri Museveni is expected to address the nation in the next few days.
This happened on a bus that was going to the west of the country. It's about 30 kilometers away from the Ugandan capital on the Kampala-Masaka road, and two people so far have been reported dead. The Ugandan police has issued a statement and confirmed the blast and say the team had been dispatched to go to the ground and find out the details. that statement was issued about an hour ago.
Alex, this is coming on the heels of another bomb blast, I think 2 or 3 days ago, this one in Kampala. Has anyone claimed responsibility for this latest blast?
Yes, a group that claimed responsibility today is the Islamist group. The president of Uganda is set to address the country later in the week about this incident.
President Museveni said following the first blast over the weekend that this was the work of terrorists. I'm wondering if it is true now, why would terrorists want to be targeting Uganda at this time?
At the moment, I think it is not very clear why they would target Uganda at the time is. But just a few days ago, I think the UK government issued an alert and said Uganda was a target of international terrorism ring. I think Uganda's involvement in the region, especially in Somalia, makes it a permanent target of terror attacks. So, I mean, Uganda being a target of terror attacks should not be surprising. And then, of course, Uganda has been involved in several security missions in the region, in the DRC, in Central African Republic. So it's always bound to be a target of repercussions for that involvement.
Ugandans are just coming out of COVID-19 restrictions. This must be frightening for many people in Uganda right now.
Yes, it is a cause of concern for very many, coming on the backdrop of the destruction that the COVID-19 restrictions have been. So it is quite concerning for very many whose livelihoods have been disrupted by COVID, and they are getting them back. And now they have to be on the lookout or to be extremely, very careful because of these incidents, especially for those people who work every day in very congested areas in downtown Kampala and the surrounds of the capital Kampala. So it is a very, very serious issue.
Alex Atuhaire is the editor of the Uganda PML Daily. He was speaking with us from the capital Kampala. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 26th. The northeastern Somali state of Puntland on Monday conducted direct local council elections that will serve as a model for other parts of Somalia later. The last time Somalia held democratic polls was more than 50 years ago. Somalia's indirect presidential and parliamentary polls were delayed several times as political tension hampered the process. Only the self-declared region of Somaliland held direct elections after 1991. Mohamed Kahia reports from Mogadishu.
According to Transitional Electoral Commission of Puntland State, more than 46,000 people registered for the polls, in which 8 parties are vying for its 7 council seats in Ufuein, Ail and Qardo districts. The leader of Puntland, Saeed Abdullahi Deni, whose Kah party faced stiff competition on Monday, said the polls were a landmark event. He said, "I'm happy to witness this historic day in the state, where peaceful polls are conducted after 54 years. He added, "It is a historic day for residents of the state and the country as well." An 80-year-old man who voted in Somalia's last elections more than 5 decades ago said he was happy to take part in the democratic process. He said, "I'm very happy and excited to vote while I'm 80 years old without being forced." He added that the last time he voted was in 1968. The following year, in 1969, witnessed Somalia's only nationwide one-person, one-vote elections. Since then, elections for public office, when they take place, have been polls of lawmakers or specially appointed delegates. Reni Lavirieri observed Monday's election for Interpeace, a Swiss-based NGO, and was pleased with what she saw.
We've noticed that there's a lot of enthusiasm. Participants have lined up from the early hours this morning when we came to the polls at the first polling station earlier this morning at 6 a.m. There were already hundreds and hundreds of people that were waiting to vote. So you can really see the excitement and that people really want to cast their vote for the first time in history for many of them.
The UN Office for Somalia expressed hope the elections will inspire other regions in Somalia to hold democratic polls. It said in a statement, the successful completion of one-person, one-vote elections in Qarto, Eyl and Ofwein will be an important step in showing the feasibility of universal suffrage elections at a local, state and national levels across the country. Somalia was due to hold indirect presidential and parliamentary elections this year, but the polls have been postponed multiple times due to threats from militant group Al-Shabaab and disagreements among political leaders about the process. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
In Eswatini, the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, TUKOSWA, is demanding the immediate and unconditional release of all political prisoners before any dialogue. The workers' group says exiled critics of the administration forced to flee their country should be allowed to return home to be part of the dialogue to find a solution to the ongoing political unrest in the Southern African Kingdom. This after TUKOSWA, together with the Swaziland Multi Stakeholders Forum, presented a petition to Parliament on Monday. Undudisi Jina is the Secretary General for the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that the workers' group is also demanding an international investigation of what he says are ongoing human rights abuses.
We wanted to inform Parliament that, in fact, us as workers, we believe in dialogue to resolve issues. And then to say that a dialogue should be in a climate that is conducive for a dialogue. And one of those issues that he identified to be issues that must be addressed before a genuine dialogue could happen would be the release of all political prisoners. And there are some other political leaders that are now in exile as a result of the hostile political environment in the country are saying, again, those must be allowed to return to the country unconditionally. We were then to say to Parliament,
the King's call, some suggest, is the only way by which it will be acceptable to the authorities for dialogue. So if the authorities are not agreeing to the terms of the dialogue, what happens?
There are some treaties and protocols that rules and governs issues of genuine political engagement and how the ground should be leveled for a genuine political negotiations to okay or dialogue to okay. We then said to Parliament, Parliament must cause for an independent investigation to okay. But as a federation, we are saying, and we are saying it with all the confidence and authority, that the people, the more than 80 people that were killed in June, and in June, they were killed by the army and they were killed by the police. But the government, on the other hand, is saying they were killed by South Africans.
Multi-stakeholders forum, as well as TUKOSWA, are saying that if the conditions are not right for dialogue, you will escalate the ongoing political crisis. Basically, some people are saying that will threaten the country's stability. How do you respond to that?
The escalation, in our definition, it would refer to a situation that would render the country ungovernable. People are angry. And all that we are saying is that we no longer reason with the people to reason. We will allow them to think and to act and to decide on issues as they will be individually thinking. Otherwise, now we are still channeling our members to think in a civilized manner, to resolve issues in a civilized manner, like agreeing to resolve the issues through dialogue. But if then the dialogue is frustrated, we are saying we should not be blamed for our individual members thinking and acting and deciding issues as they would want.
That was Undudisi Jina, Secretary General of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotin. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on Monday launched the country's digital currency, the e-Naira, also called Nigerian Central Bank Digital Currency, the CBDC. The launch makes Nigeria the first country in Africa to tap into the popularity of crypto and virtual money to adopt the digital currency. Authorities say the launch will make transactions easier and improve financial inclusion for millions who are unbanked. But some experts say there might be challenges. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The official launch of the Central Bank of Nigeria digital currency, CBDC, took place at the State House in Abuja on Monday, with top government officials attending. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari unveiled the e-Naira and said it could potentially boost Nigeria's gross domestic product by up to $29 billion over the next decade. Blockchain technology expert Jadel Chidi welcomes the launch.
Digital currency helps to faster payments, you know, and is also supposedly less expensive than the regular payment systems you have already. And you make your transactions, you know, person to person. You don't need an intermediary.
The e-Naira app went live and became available for citizens to download immediately after the launch. A digital currency is a means of payment that exists purely in electronic form. Other types include the cryptocurrency, which authorities banned in February, saying its instability exposed citizens to huge financial risks. The government expects the e-Naira to improve store of value for Nigeria's weakening currency, as well as drive financial inclusion for millions of citizens. But digital money experts like Janet Katio say internet penetration and tech savviness could present initial problems.
For every technology that is new, people have to learn how to use it. It is no different with the digital currency, the e-Naira, or even the cryptocurrency. People need to learn how to use these things.
Jadel Chidi says there are also concerns about the e-Naira's regulation by Nigeria's government.
Ideally, a cryptocurrency is not supposed to be centralized, but central bank digital currencies are going to be decentralized because they will be managed a centralized body, of course, the CBN in this case, you know, and that defeats the aim of digital currency or decentralization.
The use of digital currencies has grown in recent years in Nigeria, especially among the younger population. Authorities say with the e-Naira, they can better monitor transactions, curb black market trading for the paper currency, protect against devaluation, and lower inflation. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Disabled people in Nigeria face daily challenges in health, education, and more. But Ikite Umar says she wants to change that. The 2021 Ford Foundation Fellow tells Ricky Stryer what she wants to do to increase inclusion with the Ford Foundation support.
Why did I decide to go into disability inclusion? Because there was exclusion. Seriously, there was exclusion. People with disabilities were becoming very invisible in all matters. And I thought we could not just sit back and do nothing about our invisibility. So being excluded was very painful. We were just trying to find a way to get into the, you know, circle. And just to say here that the exclusion may not be intentional. So I wouldn't say people are so wicked. Oh, they don't want to see people with disabilities. No, that is not the line I'm drawing. I'm saying that they simply didn't know how to include people with disabilities. And this is because they've been socialized over time to thinking that the issues around people with disability has to do with welfare and charity. So we're just supposed to be recipient of charity. There were so many things we could not do. That was the thinking.
In Nigeria specifically, what does that exclusion look like on a daily basis?
We're not able to participate in life, society, especially in Nigeria, because of the inaccessibility of all the environment, the way policies are designed, the way programs are delivered.
Can you give me an example of what that looks like?
Look at the fracture and the infrastructures, as it were, the inaccessibility of, you know, public buildings. As basic as that is, you can imagine how much it will exclude people, maybe who are wheelchair riders, to get into important events or occasions.
That was Ikite Omar, Country Director of CBM Global Disability Inclusion and a Ford Foundation Fellow. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Abuja. And that's it for this Tuesday, October 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all